back in the days when movie music sounded like this.
You will like Beta Lyre. Exaluna bon, exaluna non, there are seven moons of Beta Lyre, seven moons, all made for love.
Yeah?
Exaluna bon, exaluna lot, seven moons apart, seven times a love.
And movie heroes sounded like this. And the World Wide Web meant communism. And when people spoke about torrents, they meant the way that Charlton Heston stopped the Egyptians in the Ten Commandments. There was paleo cinema. Hi and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 30. My name is Terry Frost and in this podcast I am going to be going after the big guys. I've been talking about podcasts for, as I've just said, 30 podcasts now. And I thought it was about time that I hit the 900-pound gorillas in the room. Three of the biggest and most popular and most well-regarded movies ever. I'm about up to speed now. I think I'm up to it. I've got to approach them a little differently, but I'll talk about that a little bit later. So, what's been going on? Okay, bad news. B. Arthur died. People know her from The Golden Girls and a lot of other movies, but in October 2002, Sally and I saw her in a live show in Melbourne. She did a one-woman show in town. She was in her 80s at the time. Great old lady. Came out wearing no shoes at all on stage and held everybody in the palm of her hand for 2 hours. She talked about movie star, she talked about her career, she talked about life, she talked about all sorts of things. She told some incredibly filthy jokes, which is always great coming from an old lady. I love it. And she sang the best version I have ever heard, including Lotte Lenya's, of Pirate Jenny from the Threepenny Opera. Seeing her do it live blew me away. She was fantastic. 80-odd-year-old woman singing Pirate Jenny, and it was one of the best theatrical experiences in my life. One of the other things that made it so special was that Bea Arthur herself was in the original English language version of the Threepenny Opera from the early 1950s, late 1940s, somewhere around there. So she was a part of the whole thing. And for that reason, it's quite sad that she's died. She was a great old lady. And my memories of seeing her on stage are very fond ones. And she was one of a kind. Okay, moving on. What's been happening lately, apart from people dropping off the tweak? Well, there's probably going to be a worldwide swine flu pandemic, so we're going to have to weather through that on top of the other hassles we have. What the hell, it makes for interesting times. Movies get better in rough times, so just look forward to some interesting film coming out if the studios don't get their way. Over here, I'm recovering from the flu. I've still got a bit of a rough throat and a touch of mucus, but doing well. Nothing much else happening here through my big birthday party, as I mentioned in the last podcast. And by the way, the response to the movie music podcast was fantastic. So thank you to everybody who gave feedback on that. I'll do them again at some stage. I don't want to just kind of rest on my laurels and turn into a DJ and just play movie music with a whole bunch of little bits of narrative in between. It's not what I want to do. But I thought just while I had a bit of spare time, I'd do it. And you guys have responded well to it. The podcast is doing very well. We're getting well over 500 hits a month. So please keep it up. Please continue voting for it over at Podcast Alley. And I've got something new on the website at paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. If I'm talking about movies during the podcast, I'm going to put up a link to buying the movies or a book related to the movies from Amazon.com. Time to start monetizing this deal. So if you click through on the little carousel thing you'll see on the site, if you are interested in buying it, I'll get a little bit of kickback. I'm not getting any money out of it, but I'll probably end up with some Amazon vouchers, which is never a bad thing. So if things are available, you can get them through there. If you click through there, I get a little bit of a kickback for it. Up to you, but I thought I'd just put that up there, A, as a service, and B, as a little bit of a experiment for the podcast. So if you are interested to do that, I'll talk about letters first. First thing I did was I got a voicemail. David Munn sent me an MP3 voicemail, which I'm now going to play, and then address. So thank you, David. I know you're a bit nervous about doing it, but it is appreciated, and the feedback is always welcome. So I'll just play that for you now.
Hi, Terry. This is David in Adelaide. I've loved Bedazzled for many, many years. There's so many great bits in that movie. I love the bit where Peter Cook is collecting charity donations for depraved criminals, and the bit where they fool the old lady into going out and buying more bottles of Fruini's Green Eye Wash in hopes of winning a date with Alfred Hitchcock. One bit that you didn't mention is, of course, the presence of Racco Welsh as Lillian Lust, the babe with the bust. Apparently, Dudley Moore had to wear about 20 pairs of underpants in his bedroom scene with her because he was afraid of embarrassing himself. But then I've loved most of the films that Peter Cook and Dudley Moore worked on in their TV series. I even like Hound of the Baskervilles, which is a very, very silly movie, but I think a lot of fun. How can you not like a movie in which Peter Cook is shown reading a book called Guilt Without Sex by Sigmund Freud? I still find it hard to believe that that film was directed by Paul Morrissey, he of Flesh Trash and Heat and Flesh for Frankenstein and Blood for Dracula. I also recommend a telly movie called Not Only But Always. It came out in 2004 to give an idea of about the personal lives of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. Rhys Ifans plays Peter Cook, and both he and the actor who play Dudley Moore are spookily like the real thing. Peter Cook also did a very funny movie called The Rise and Rise of Michael Rimmer, which is a very good political satire, if you ever get a chance to see that. And I also wanted to make a suggestion for a show that you could do, is maybe you could have one centering on the films of William Castle. I've been a big William Castle fan for many years. I love films like The Tingler and Homicidal. And one of his rarer films that I got to see again recently, having not seen it since I was a teenager, is Let's Kill Uncle, which is a great fun movie with Nigel Green giving a very memorable performance as a gentlemanly villain who's trying to kill two kids, and they're trying to kill him before he can kill them, and it's a lot of fun. Anyway, keep up the good podcasts.
Thanks for that, David. I really appreciate the feedback and your support for the podcast over a couple of years now, so thank you very much for that. Yeah, I didn't mention Racco Welsh, and I realised that I hadn't mentioned her after I finished and uploaded the podcast. To be honest with you, I don't think she made that much of an impact on me. Yes, she looks spectacular, and she did a southern accent, but Racco Welsh always seemed to me to have a kind of veneer of sexiness with no real sexiness beneath it. I mean, people can disagree. Everybody's tastes are different. But someone like, say, Anne Margaret always struck me as being much more sexy than Racco Welsh, who always seemed to wear it as a facade. So maybe that's why I forgot to do it. The idea of the William Castle podcast, yeah, definitely a possibility. I've added it to my book of things I should do on the podcast, and I'm more than happy to do that. I did mention The Tingler when I did my Vincent Price podcast, but yeah, I've got a few other William Castle things. There was one I saw recently which was quite unusual. I'm just going to have to think of the name of it. Oh, yeah, that's right, The Spirit is Willing, which I think had Sid Caesar in it, among other people, and was about a bunch of people on a boat being haunted by a couple of ghosts and things. It was quite silly, but I thought the comedy worked really well, even though the structure of it and the budget was quite low. So I've got a basic looking ripped from video torrent of that movie, but I want to actually sit down and rewatch it. So the castle idea is definitely on the back burner, along with a whole bunch of other ones that I've mentioned in the past. Not enough time to do all the podcasts that I want to do, to be honest. But thank you again for that voicemail, David. And I do really appreciate it. It came across fine. So don't worry about that. Yeah, I haven't checked out that docudrama kind of thing on Peter Cook and Dudley Moore yet. I have seen Fantabuloso, the one that was done on Kenneth Williams. I saw the one that was done about Frankie Howard. And I saw the one that was done about Harry H. Corbett and Wilfred Bramble about the Steptoe thing. So the English did a few of these a few years back. But the Peter Cook and Dudley Moore one I'll probably pick up on a torrent at some stage and watch. So thank you for that recommendation. I've got a few. I've got one from a lady called Beverly Ann, who just asked me what the picture was on the website when I had the Phantom of the Paradise picture, and told me to keep up with a good podcast. Just a few other little notes from the usual suspects. I won't go into them too much because I've got a lot to do this time. Excuse me for a moment if there's some noise outside. It's quite windy and rainy outside, so if you hear things blowing around in the background, nothing dangerous is happening. It's just that the weather's getting up a little bit. Okay, so I decided I was going to hit the really big movies. Not all the time, just this once. So I thought, what can I do? Okay, what are the three biggest movies that movie buffs like? Orson Welles, Citizen Kane, first off, right. Casablanca. Got to put Casablanca in there. And for a bit of variety, I decided to do La Dolce Vita. So they're the three movies I'm going to look at this podcast. Yep, I'm going to try to tackle the biggies. The problem with doing that, though, is that there's been so much written and so much known about these films, it's very hard to tackle them from a new viewpoint, particularly in a podcast. So what I've done is I've done a bit of homework. I've actually looked at physical books rather than just the web, the way I sometimes do. I've picked up my copy of I, Fellini, which is Fellini's autobiography. I picked up a copy of Simon Callow's first volume of his Orson Welles biography, Orson Welles, The Road to Xanadu. And I've done a lot of research on Casablanca in various ways. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk around the edges of the films. Everybody knows them pretty well, but I just thought I'd talk about the way they've affected me and the way I see them. I am going to be going over some material that's been dealt with elsewhere, but I really want to also look at why I think these movies are as well regarded as they are. So I'll start off with the oldest of the movies, Citizen Kane.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Orson Welles. I'm speaking for the Mercury Theater, and what follows is supposed to advertise our first motion picture. Citizen Kane is the title, and we hope it can correctly be called a coming attraction. It's certainly coming to this theater. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what you'll think about Mr. Kane. I can't imagine. You see, I play the part myself. Well, Kane is a hero and a scoundrel, a no-account and a swell guy, a great lover, a great American citizen, and a dirty dog. It depends on who's talking about him. What's the real truth about Charles Foster Kane? I wish you'd come to this theater when Citizen Kane plays here and decide for yourself.
Apart from being one of the best regarded movies in cinema history, Citizen Kane has kind of metadata around it. The story of how the movie was made and the story of the attempts by William Randolph Hearst to buy the movie and have it destroyed have created an entity larger than the film itself. There's been at least one movie, RKO 281, about the making of Citizen Kane, starring Liev Schreiber as Orson Welles. If you can get a copy of that, and it's not expensive, it's well worth having for that reason. There's a documentary that comes with the two-volume DVD set of Citizen Kane, which includes a lot of the material regarding that. So there are legends and stories and pieces of history around the making of Citizen Kane and the extraordinary circumstances of its creation that make the story so much larger than the movie itself. The story at times seems to overwhelm the narrative of the movie, which is an extraordinary thing. And I can't really think of another film about which there is such a legend. So there's an encasing narrative, which is fascinating and extraordinary, and would be inexplicable if the movie was not such a work of genius as it is. Everybody knows the story. It's a fictionalized pastiche of the life of William Randolph Hearst, and also of some aspects of Wells' early life as well. Basically, you know, Charles Foster Kane dies, and a journalist tries to discover the meaning of his last word, Rosebud. And, of course, that leads to the narrative about the idealistic beginnings of Charles Foster Kane's life, leading to his ultimately tragic ending. And, of course, people have made parallels between the life of Charles Foster Kane and the life of Orson Welles himself. I can understand why it's an easy shortcut to say that, but I don't think that that's necessarily the case. I think even though Welles did end up being basically the world's best and most recognisable voiceover man, from everything I can see and every bit of documentary footage I can see of him speaking about his career, he doesn't sound like he's bitter and twisted or even diminished by his lack of successes. I do remember at an award ceremony, he was almost begging for the money to complete his last film, The Other Side of the Wind. The film was... everything was in the can, but Welles never had the resources to complete the editing process. The film still exists, and there are still people who are trying to get together the rights and the ability to edit the film as Welles would have wanted it, and I do hope to see it someday. Even if it's not a perfect film, which I don't expect it to be, I do want to see Orson Welles' last unfinished film. But leaving that aside, one of the things that fascinates me about Citizen Kane is the fact that it's a movie that could not be made now. Imagine this. We'll try giving a modern day parallel to the creation of Citizen Kane. Just say there's somebody who maybe was a radio DJ, a radio star of some kind, who went to Hollywood and wanted to make a movie fictionalizing the life of, for instance, Rupert Murdoch. Guy's about 24 years old. He's had a couple of really big publicity stunts in his past, and he wants to make a movie about the life of Rupert Murdoch. It's inconceivable that a large movie studio would give somebody like that carte blanche to make the movie with no interference, no studio ability to see the dailies. Orson Welles, for Citizen Kane, had final cut. He had all the rights to this film. He basically got the best movie deal in the history of movies as far as the director's concerned, and the guy was 24 years old. These days, people are barely starting their career in cinema at the age of 24. And the amazing thing and the tragedy of Orson Welles is the fact that he peaked at 24. 24 to 25, he had his 25th birthday while the film was in production. And after that, things were never quite the same, and he became quite philosophical about that ultimately. But one of the reasons why Citizen Kane became such an iconic piece of cinema is the fact that Welles, coming from a theatrical and radio background, knew that he needed collaborators. He needed people to cooperate with him. He brought a whole bunch of actors from his Mercury Theatre to Hollywood to star in this film, and a lot of them, that was their first movie. People like Joseph Cotten and Agnes Moorehead and George Kalouris and Ray Collins and Everett Sloan hadn't made a movie as well, and he ultimately went on to a long and distinguished career. He had such an ensemble there, but when it came to the art of cinema itself. He was a total neophyte. But he was very fortunate in hooking up with Herman J. Mankiewicz, the screenwriter for Citizen Kane. Now, Mankiewicz was a problematic figure. He'd written a lot of very popular movies, but he was a drunk. Basically, Wells travelled up to where he was drying out to help write the script for Citizen Kane. There's a lot of mythology and a lot of conflicting information about whose idea the movie was originally, whether it was Mankiewicz's, because Mankiewicz had spent some time in San Simeon with William Randolph Hearst and Marion Davies, or whether it was Wells's idea, or there's a lot of conflicting information there, and I won't really go into it. If you want to research it, it is quite an interesting part of cinema history. So the first big collaboration Wells did was getting Mankiewicz in on the script. The next bit of smart finagling he did was to get, as cinematographer, Greg Toland, who was working in the studio system. He worked for a number of different studios, but was never really a studio man. He was an ideas guy. He was arguably the best cinematographer in Hollywood at the time. And the boy genius came along, and Greg Toland was asked to do impossible things with the focal length of shots, with lighting. There are half of the ceilings you see in Citizen Kane, for instance, are actually not physical ceilings. They're made out of muslin so that light can shine through them, and therefore Toland could light the sets the way that Wells wanted it. I've got a little bit of a sound clip of Orson Welles talking about his collaboration with Greg Toland and Citizen Kane, and I'll just play that to give you a bit of an idea of it.
Toland was a technician who agreed with that, which is a fantastic thing. On the first day I arrived, I thought, after years of being a director in the theater, that the lights were set by the director, since they are in the theater. So I said, this is where it will be. Now let's move this light over here, and so on. I set the lights. Behind me, Toland was motioning to all the people, shut up, let him go ahead. And then balancing behind me without my knowing it, you see. I worked 5 days like that until somebody told me, and I realized what a terrible thing I'd been doing. And Toland was furious that I'd been told.
That's very interesting.
It's a great tribute to him, I think. And he said, you don't know what it means because you don't look at it from formula. So the minute I realized that, then I began asking for things which in my ignorance were impossible to do. Nobody ever asked. That I didn't intend as innovations. It just seemed to me that anything in a frame that you could look at, you ought to be able to do these things. Mm-hmm. So Toland said, let's go ahead and try. Now, under my contract, nobody could look at the rushes but me. If we ruined something, it didn't matter. Toland had that wonderful spirit, so we just went ahead and tried. So it was partly the great spirit of Toland, the fact that he was the greatest cameraman who ever lived and the fastest, and had that wonderful spirit, and partly my own ignorance. I didn't know what you couldn't do. I didn't deliberately set out to invent anything. It just seemed to me, why not? And there is a great gift that ignorance has to bring to anything, you know. That was the gift I brought to Kane, was ignorance.
There are another of other collaborators that helped Wells a lot with Citizen Kane, particularly a guy called Perry Ferguson, who was the art director. He and Wells really worked well together to get the look and the feel of the film just right. They spent a lot of time in the looking at old sets at RKO and finding the bits and pieces for it and just generating the look of the film. So I think Perry Ferguson's definitely one of the lesser sung heroes of Citizen Kane. He worked really well with Wells and did a lot of fine work for that, and of course was nominated for an Oscar for the art direction. The only Oscar that Citizen Kane ended up winning in 1940 was for screenplay. In spite of the fact that it has had such a wonderful reputation since then, that's the only one that they actually got a gong for. As far as William Randolph Hearst's response to the film's concern was concerned, he tried to buy all the prints of it from RKO for $800,000, which was a hell of a lot of money at the time, and of course to some of us it still is. So he actually wanted to destroy the film because of the, not because of himself necessarily. Everything I can find indicates that the reason he was pissed off with it was not because of its portrayal of him, but because of its portrayal of Marion Davies, his mistress. A lot of people say that the reason for this is that Rosebud was a reference to a pet name that Hearst had for Marion Davies' clitoris. Gore Vidal in 1989 particularly pushed this this idea, and Gore Vidal being a bit of a puckish person, I think he may have just been stirring the shit a little bit there. The best information that I was able to find on this, and I've gone to about four different sources, I've looked at about three or four different reference books, including Rosebud, David Thompson's biography of Wells, and Barbara Leeming's Orson Welles, which is a bit an idolatrous biography of Orson Welles. But the best information I've got in general is that Rosebud was the name of a brand of bicycle that Herman Mankiewicz had as a child. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it does sound good to say that it was actually a reference to somebody's clitoris, but the truth, unfortunately, isn't quite that colourful from everything I can gather. Basically, Hearst's problem with the film was because it portrayed the Marion Davies character, Susan Alexander Kane, as a drunken and talentless person. And if anything, Marion Davies was a gifted actress in her day. She was very good at light comedy, and she had quite a presence on the screen. So it wasn't an accurate picture of her. Orson Welles came from the Midwest. So I think that the person he was thinking of when he created the Susan Alexander Kane character was actually an opera singer in early 20th century Chicago, not too far from where Welles grew up. Her husband was very wealthy, and he did put her in a number of performances of the opera, and the woman had a shit singing voice, no talent at all, and they became something of a laughingstock in Chicago society for that reason. Her name was Ilona something or other. I can't quite find the reference again, but the best indication I have is that that was the actual role model for the character of Susan Alexander Kane in Citizen Kane. In later years, Welles did regret the unkindness that people presumed he was directing at Marion Davies. He did feel a great deal of remorse for that and apologetic for it. Both Davies and Hearst had died at this stage, but Welles, in his later years, became more philosophical about that and saying that it was a young man's folly to portray things that way. Ultimately, that's a story that, as far as I can figure it out. Now, the legends around Kane are fantastic, as I've said, and it's well worth anybody's time to look into them, particularly if you're a movie buff, and of course you are listening to this podcast. But it's the stuff surrounding the making of the movie that I find fascinating, the history behind it, the politics behind it, the snapshot of society as it was at the time that allowed somebody to have the influence that Hearst and his newspapers had to try to crush the production of a film. I don't doubt that there are media moguls in these days who have that power. I don't doubt for a second that somebody like Rupert Murdoch couldn't have a movie chopped for those particular reasons, but I don't think it would be considered, it would happen for PR reasons. The negative publicity would more than overwhelm any benefit from trying to suppress a movie. So they were very different times, and I think that the public, A, has more access to media these days, and B, is more aware of the potential powers and abuses of media than they were in 1940 when Citizen Kane came out. That's about all I want to say about the film. If you haven't seen it, I'm surprised. If you haven't seen it lately, it's probably time to revisit it and maybe look at one of the two of the documentaries or docudramas about the film. It's a big part of cinema history, and hopefully I've given you something to think about it. So next we're going to Casablanca.
Casablanca, city of hope and despair, located in French Morocco in North Africa. the meeting place of adventurers, fugitives, criminals, refugees lured into this danger-swept oasis by the hope of escape to the Americas. But they're all trapped, for there is no escape. Against this fascinating background is woven the story of an imperishable love and the enthralling saga of six desperate people, each in Casablanca to keep an appointment with destiny.
I was willing to shoot Captain Reno, and I'm willing to shoot you.
All right, Major, you asked for it.
You knew how much I loved you. How much I still love you.
I know a good deal more about you than you suspect. I know, for instance, that you're in love with a woman. It's perhaps a strange circumstance that we both should love the same woman.
What do you want for Sam?
I don't buy and sell human beings.
That's too bad. That's Casablanca's leading commodity.
You can ask any price you want, but you must give me those letters.
That's no deal.
All right. I tried to reason with you. I tried everything. Now I want those letters.
Casablanca is a perfect example of a movie that came at the right time with the right people involved in it. I mean, technically it shouldn't have worked as a movie, particularly as a classic film. There are logical plot holes in it. There are bits that don't make sense. For an American movie, it's an incredibly international piece of work. The director, Michael Curtiz, wasn't American-born. Only three or four of the actors in the whole film. And this is a major Warner Brothers production in 1942, were even born in America. There are an incredibly wide range of accents in this film. I mean, I'm not even going to bother to tell you the plot because you know it already. You're very familiar with the film, but this is the stuff that I really get from rewatching Casablanca. That sheer embracing of internationalism. You got to remember the times in which this film was made. They made the scenes in Paris with Rick and Ilsa at a time when the Nazis had occupied Paris, as it shows in the film. People who have been to Paris love Paris. Sally says she doesn't. When I talk to her about our trip to Paris, she says she doesn't understand the fuss, but we keep talking about it at various times. So there is an emotional linkage for anybody who visits that city. And I just tried to do a bit of a mental experiment on how I'd feel about the Nazis having occupied Paris. One of the things we did when we were in Paris, and this is just to give you a background about how I feel about Casablanca and the whole milieu of the film. One of the things we did was we went around the back of Notre Dame Cathedral, and around the back there's a simple short wall which is the memorial to all the French people, Jews and gypsies and homosexuals and political dissidents who were placed in concentration camps by the Nazis. It's right on the banks of the Seine. It's on that little island where Notre Dame Cathedral is. And there are other bits of it that are reminders of World War II when you travel around Paris. There are streets named after resistance fighters, men and women. The streets have been there for hundreds of years, but they've been renamed after the heroes who fought to keep France free. That emotional linkage makes Casablanca, oddly enough, a stronger film for me. I mean, have a look at the actors who are in it as well. Remember, the time that this film was made, people did not know how the war was going to go. They didn't know whether England was going to be conquered and whether America would be an isolated bastion against fascism in the whole planet. That's what a world war is. Everything's at stake. Everything's in the balance. Yeah, I mean, Ingrid Bergman, she was Swedish. Paul Henreid, he was Austrian or Hungarian or something like that. And Peter Lorre, he'd fled the Nazis as well. A lot of the main actors had direct connection and direct contact with the Nazis in their own personal lives, not just in movies, in their own personal lives. Conrad Veidt, who plays Major Strasser, the chief Nazi in this film, was held captive in Germany for a period of time by the Nazis. He was going to flee to England to make a movie called Jus Suisse 1934, but the Nazis held him there for a while under the fiction that he was too ill to travel. It wasn't until Ealing Studios in England basically pressured them. This is the early days of the Nazis. This is before they became what they later became. But there was pressure brought to have Conrad Veidt freed from Germany and from essentially house arrest from the Nazis. So a lot of these actors knew what this film was about at a deeper and more visceral level than a lot of the American people involved in it. Probably the most crucial scene that demonstrates this in Casablanca is the bit where the Germans in the nightclub start singing Watching the Rhine, and Paul Henri gets the band to play La Marseillaise. Now, there is some evidence from the people who were there at the time when they were filming that part. Got to remember, most of the extras, most of the actors in that scene, in that movie, were themselves refugees from Nazis. And they all sang La Marseillaise. And the best evidence I've got is that there were genuine tears in everyone's eyes as they were singing that, which is one of the reasons why that's such a powerful piece of Casablanca. And there was genuine emotion about the subject matter, even though it was an entertainment, even though it was a studio film at the time. Warner Brothers always was hard on its sleeve regarding being against all forms of fascism, basically. I mean, they did movies like The Black Legion. There were the Warner Brothers themselves kept a lot of refugee actors on the payroll when they didn't really have any work for them, because they knew that they had to help the people who had fled this horrible plague of political plague that had swept around the earth. So Casablanca is a movie of a particular time, strengthened by its own theme and by the people who acted in it. It's one of the reasons why it resonates so much. I mean, leaving aside the very, very obvious things, the fact that Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman had that wonderful chemistry, and Bogart, for the first time in his movie career, allowed himself to be vulnerable, allowed himself to essentially cry, and allowed himself to essay that kind of emotion in a film. Where he could have got away with not doing it. I mean, it could have just been a standard tough guy role, the role of Rick in Casablanca. But Bogart basically stuck his neck out. Rick says he sticks his neck out for nobody, but Bogart, the actor, stuck his neck out and created one of the best love stories in cinema history. So, and there are a few other aspects of this film that I really love. I love the fact that Sam, the Dooley Wilson character, is treated as a human being. Black actors and black characters in cinema weren't often, at that stage, treated as well as Sam is in Casablanca. Sam is Rick's best friend. Renault, later on perhaps, but Sam is, in a sense, Rick's conscience. He knows who he used to be. He knows who he is now. He knows the pain that's going to be caused by Ilsa walking into the Café Américain. That shows that the people making this film were ahead of the curve when it came to a lot of these issues. And again, that feeds back into giving this movie longevity. The fact that we can see and relate to the film as much as people can these days is partly because we know that everybody's fighting on the right side. Those linkages between character, the subtle way Ingrid Bergman's looks down when she speaks, the hesitations, the way Bogart's rough face shows things that aren't said in the character, are just wonderful cultural artifacts for us all to enjoy and to just love. Casablanca, if you look at the bare story, if you look at the bare bones of the story, there's nothing particularly special there. It's all context. Just a perfect storm of influences. In the same sense that Citizen Kane is. that perfect confluence of actors and technicians and musicians and the times that the film was made in all created something that people find of great personal value even to this day. And you've got to remember what 1942, how long ago was 1942? 60, almost 70 years ago. Probably more. My maths has all gone out the hill. It's still a bit fluey. But the film, if you don't have this in your collection, you really shouldn't. And that's essentially what I'm saying. Every couple of years I can drag it out, I can enjoy it, and I can find new little bits of things that I wasn't aware of that really make this film something special for me. I don't know if I've told this story before, but I've actually been in Rick's Cafe Americana. If you go to Movie World in Queensland, they've made Rick's Cafe Americana as one of the attractions, in a sense, on the main street. It's a restaurant. So you go in there and they've got TVs mounted on the walls that are showing Casablanca. They've got Sam's upright piano, well, something made up to look like Sam's upright piano in the corner of the room. And you can go in there, you can have lunch and just kind of suck up the ambience. The internal layout isn't particularly the same as the in the movie. And to be honest, the food is pretty cafeteria shit. But the idea of just having lunch in Rick's Cafe Americana appealed to me so much that we kind of didn't quite forgive them that shit food. But it was something good, and we had our photo taken out the front of it, as you do, and did all that touristy stuff. But in a weird sense, it was a cultural icon as well. But I really would have preferred if the food was good. So I won't talk too much more about Casablanca. Just that a movie of its time really has the ability to have a powerful effect on us as an audience. And I think that there is the potential now, as our times become weird and chaotic and interesting, for there to be films with that same kind of impact made, if only the right people, with the right support from the right studios, care to make them. I don't know what kind of films are going to be, but I think there is that potential in troubled times for films to be made that, apart from lifting the spirits of an audience, speak to the concerns of the time and speak to the better angels of our nature. Now, I don't know what those films are going to be, but I do hope to see them. I do hope that all of this shitstorm that the world is going through at the moment produces something like that for us to savour and for us to pass on to future generations, saying this is who we were and this is what we aspired to. In Casablanca, the better angels of the characters do ultimately prevail. Okay, I'm just going to take a little bit of a break, have a coffee, and I'll get back and I'll talk a little bit about La Dolce Vita.
What is your nationality?
I'm a drunkard. This gun is pointed right at your heart.
That is my least vulnerable spot.
Dolce Vita is a kind of a hard movie for me to talk about in this podcast. It's a very complex film. It's an episodic kind of mosaic film of various events in the life of a journalist come publicity agent called Marcello, played by Marcello Mastroianni. And the movie's about 2.75 hours long. It's quite a long film. There's a lot in the film, and It's a really difficult one to pin down. I don't have the technical knowledge of cinema to be able to do some aspects of this film justice, and I'll be honest about that. I can just talk to you about how I enjoy it, how I feel. But I do come up against my limitations when I try to talk about this film. I just kind of give a breakdown of what I feel, what I enjoy, and the bits of the film that really touch me. It's widely agreed that basically the movie's in seven parts. There's Marcello's evening with the heiress Maddalena, played by Anouk Aimée, where they basically spend the night in the slightly flooded basement apartment of a prostitute they meet on the street and decide to give a lift home to. That's the first one. The second part, which is probably the most iconic part from a lot of people's viewpoint, is a long and frustrating night that Marcello spends with the American actress Sylvia, played by Anita Ekberg, that ends in the Trevi Fountain at dawn. This is also the bit that stars Lex Barker, who later went on to have a long and interesting film career in Europe. He did a lot of Dr. Mabuse movies and a lot of crimi films in Germany, for instance. This, I think, was probably one of his first European movies. The next bit is one of the ones that I find most striking and interesting is Marcello's relationship with the intellectual Steiner, played by Alain Cuny, which has got three sequences: the encounter he has with him at the start, the party, and the tragedy. I'll talk about that just a little bit more later. The fourth bit is a fake miracle that occurs in a vacant block of land in Rome. The fifth one, which is quite touching, is Marcello's father's visit to him when he and Marcello go out to a nightclub, and he sees his father in an entirely new light as a result of that. The sixth part is the aristocrats' party that Marcello goes to, where they basically go trying to do a seance in a haunted castle, and a sort of orgy at a beach house. So that doesn't really give much of a view of the film, and it's hard to really pin this film down. I can talk a little bit about what some of the influences on Fellini were to make this movie, but again, I come up against my own limitations. Fellini said that one of the big influences on this film when he was making it was Balenciaga's sack dress. It was a style of dress that Balenciaga came out with in the 1960s, which was basically a rectangular sack kind of dress, which had the ability to make women whose figures weren't particularly good appear sexier than they were. And for some reason, this is one of the things that Fellini found interesting and decided to make a film about the decadent nightlife of Rome. And for that reason, because of that decadent, and this film was censored and the Vatican hated it, and it was banned in Spain until 1975 when Franco went out of power. It was considered an incredibly evil and decadent movie because it showed homosexuals, it showed nightclubs, it showed sex with people who weren't married, it showed some incredibly striking scenes of suicide and prostitutes and all sorts of demi-monde characters that weren't particularly shown in a lot of movies at that stage, even in Europe. But I'll leave aside all that stuff. I'll talk about the bits of the movie I find striking. The Anita Ekberg stuff, yeah, I can understand the attraction. I can understand why. I mean, the woman's figure is almost a caricature of women in some way. That big, busty figure in the black evening gown, the long blonde hair. And Anita Ekberg was striking, but they're not the bits of the movie that I find really touching. I mean, I like the bit with Marcello and his father in the nightclub, where his father basically picks up one of the nightclub girls and takes her back to an apartment and has some kind of anxiety attack or heart murmur or something like that. And Marcello comes in there and suddenly sees his father not as the bright, decadent creature he was in the nightclub, but it's as if he ages suddenly during that period of time he spends in the apartment of the girl, and how he appears more touching and diminished, and how Marcello sees him in a vast arc of character during that period of time. I liked that part. The bit that I found most striking when I first saw this movie was the scenes with Steiner. And I'm going to do a spoiler here, so fast forward if you don't want to hear a spoiler. But the bit where Steiner commits suicide after killing his two children came as a great shock to me when I was watching the film. And of course it came as a shock to the character of Marcello, who saw Steiner as having the ideal life. He had an intellectual life, he had an attractive wife who loved him, he had children. He seemed to have the whole ball of wax to Marcello, and yet he was so despairing that he committed suicide and killed his children. That, in a sense, is the bit that shocked me. But the bits that really shocked me, and this links into how La Dolce Vita has added a word to the English language. Steiner's wife is walking back to their apartment and suddenly finds herself surrounded by photographers and doesn't know what's happening. She thinks that they think she's an actress. And for some reason they're taking photos of her, and she's flattered and embarrassed and doesn't quite know what's happening until she's taken away to a car and somebody tells her there's been an accident. And she's had this moment of joy at the attention being paid to her until somebody comes along and tells her the reason why they're taking the photos of her. That just blew me away when I saw it. It's one of the most amazing bits of cinema and the saddest bits of cinema that I know of. And as I said, it links into how, well, actually two terms in the English language. La Dolce Vita itself, the sweet life, that has become a part of our language. There are any number of Italian restaurants called La Dolce Vita, with no sense of irony. In any city, any major city you go to, there'll be some place called La Dolce Vita. And the other thing is Paparazzo, who is Marcello's sidekick photographer, who takes the photos for the stories that Marcello writes. And the name of that character has given us the word paparazzi, which has become a large part of our media landscape these days. So this film was actually added to the English language in a couple of different ways. And there are not many movies that have actually done that. How many movies have added a word to a language? And particularly a word not of the native language. So an Italian word has been brought into the English language to describe a certain kind of photographer based on the character in La Dolce Vita. The movie has had a lot of influence. I know definitely that the movie 2 Weeks in Another Town, Vincente Minnelli's movie, which is kind of a semi-sequel to The Bad and the Beautiful, has a lot of parallels with La Dolce Vita, particularly around the scene set on the Via Veneto in Rome, and that kind of decadent Roman Cinecittà lifestyle, which is portrayed in both movies, one, of course, follows like the other. And 2 Weeks in Another Town also has a couple of the actors from La Dolce Vita as characters in that film. But one of the most oblique and interesting ways in which a work of art has been influenced by La Dolce Vita is actually a vampire novel. Now, I'm just going to go and grab it, so bear with me for one sec. Kim Newman's written a series of vampire novels, Anno Dracula, The Bloody Red Baron, and the third one set in Italy in 1959, which has two names. The first name on the original first edition that I have is Judgment of Tears, but the other name it has is Dracula Cha-Cha-Cha. Now, the book is a good book. I enjoyed it a lot. But basically, in this universe, I'll set up the universe in the book. Dracula marries Queen Victoria in Victorian era. So basically, the people who try to kill Dracula in the original Dracula novel by Bram Stoker are unsuccessful, and Dracula becomes the prince consort of England, and vampires become mainstream. They become fashionable to be a vampire or no vampires. So this story is continued in the second book into World War One, and the third book carries it on into a version of the world of La Dolce Vita. There's a character called Marcello in it. There's a vampire who very much resembles the character of Sylvia. There's a whole bunch of parallels between the book known as Dracula Cha-Cha-Cha and the whole La Dolce Vita lifestyle. So the movie has been influential. I mean, the style of the movie, the fashions, the sunglasses, the decadent and jaded lifestyle, it's had a profound influence on popular culture in a lot of ways. I only first saw the movie a few years ago. It wasn't available easily on video when VHS was out. It was only when DVD came around that I managed to score a copy, and I thought, I've got to watch La Dolce Vita. I've heard so much about it. I want to know a bit more about it. And I saw the movie, and it blew me away for various reasons. For me, it's a movie made up of little moments. It's all strung together by the character of Marcello, who I find quite an interesting and tragic character. One of the interesting things about him is that originally Fellini was thinking of getting Paul Newman for the role of Marcello. He wasn't going to call him Marcello. Fellini tended to use the first names of the actors as the names of his characters because he had trouble remembering names. But there was the thought that Paul Newman, who does get name-checked in the movie, was going to play the main character in La Dolce Vita, and the character of Steiner, the doomed intellectual. Fellini wanted Henry Fonda for that particular role, but it didn't occur. They just couldn't come to a meeting of the minds on it. So that would have made a very much different film, and I don't think as powerful a film. I think the fact that Marcello is very much a part of the Italian scene is one of the strengths of the movie. The fact that he has history with the people and the places allows that narrative thread of his sad journey through the events of the movie to be the essential chain holding the lot together. I'm not going to talk too much more about the movie, apart from the saying that the music is fantastic. There's borrowed music from other media. There are Christmas carols. There are popular songs of various kinds. Nino Rota's music for it I find interesting. I can just listen to the soundtrack album and just remember the bits of the movie as I'm listening to that soundtrack album. Not hard to find if you look in the right places, so there's just a tip for you. Just tying up the whole lot of the three movies. Citizen Kane, a movie with an incredible legend around it, and the legend is at least as large as the film is. Casablanca, which talked about courage and self-sacrifice and bravery and international cooperation in the darkest time of 20th century history. And La Dolce Vita, which talked about the story of a man whose dreams just don't seem to gel, who wanders through life, not making commitments, wanting more than he has for his life, but somehow not being able to reach it. Each movie speaks to a different aspect of the human experience, but they're all very powerful films and very highly regarded for very good reasons. Okay, that's about it for the podcast. This one's been a very difficult one for me to do because I'm talking about such iconic films and I sometimes feel a bit inadequate to talk about them. But I've given it a shot, and let me know what you think. That's about it for this time. I have no idea what I'm going to be doing for the next podcast, but it will be coming up. So thank you very much for your attention. And as I said, vote for us on Podcast Alley. If you're interested in any of the things I've talked about, there is that Amazon link on the webpage. Enjoy your movie viewing. Give me some feedback at the email address you'll hear in just a moment. And enjoy your movie going. Watching these three films has really invigorated me as far as watching cinema is concerned. It's refreshed me and it's energized me for watching movies. And that's never a bad thing. So that's about it. I'll catch you guys later and take care of yourselves. Give me feedback and start talking to each other in the various fora I've set up for that particular purpose. And of course, thanks to Sally for all her support and patience while I do the podcast and the podcast research. I don't say that often enough, but she has given me a lot of support on this. I should get her on the podcast again soon, and I will work towards that end. See you later. Goodbye.
Paleo Cinema is a 3-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode and a chat window where you can interact with other listeners, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.